One.
During the night of January the 20th, 1981, 52 American diplomats arrive in Algiers from Tehran. They can finally breathe freely after being held hostage in Iran for a very long and difficult time.
Feeling great right now. Best I've felt in 444 days.
Thank God we're home.
The hostage crisis lasted 444 days, each one an ordeal filled with psychological torture and physical abuse. For the world's most powerful nation, it was 444 days of humiliation that ended with it having to cede to the demands dictated by an Iran in the midst of its own revolutionary uprising. Several decades of resentment towards the United States spurred the events that took place from November 1979 to January 1981. Resentment that's still alive in Iran. The U.S. Embassy, focal point of the hostage crisis, and now a museum named U.S. Den of Espionage Museum, keeps hate towards America alive.
It's Sandy Rios with you. Today, we're going to be talking about Iran. And the fact is that they have been at war against us for 46 years. And most of you don't know that. And I want to make sure that by the time I finish the show today, you understand why Iran is different than Iraq. It's different than Afghanistan. It's different from all the nations that we have engaged in the Middle East. It's different. It's very different. And there is a reason why we have to put our foot down. There has to be a line in the sand. There's a reason why President Trump is doing that. And so we're going to take you back in time and explain to you why this happened the way it did. In the issue of taking these hostages, those people, the people that worked in our embassy in Tehran, were held for 444 days and tortured. Not all of them were tortured, but they were tortured, mental torture, all kinds of torture. And nobody did anything. Nobody did anything. There was an attempted rescue that was feckless. And basically, we just sat back, the United States, and let them do this to us. And Khomeini, who had just come to power, thought that we were weak. And we were. And we have been, I believe, until President Trump. President Trump seems to understand that in Islam, this kind of lack of action just is like red meat to a lion. They fight more. They hate. They hold you in disdain when you're weak. So that's what's happening right now. We're going to talk about all the other things they've done, 1983, 1984, going into the Iraq War, 9/11, all of their entanglements and ways of acting out and killing Americans. It's going to blow your mind. And I hope you'll stay tuned for this discussion. But first, we are in the business of life, and I've said before to you that Islamists, whether they're Sunni or Shia, the Iranians are Shia, they love death more than we love life. That's one of their mottos. We love death more than they love life. Well, I'm not sure that's true. It seems like the force of the gospel, the power of the Holy Spirit, the work of Christians, is the only thing that can conquer the kind of thinking that wants to do such harm to the world and kill and destroy. It's really Christ that makes a difference. And in case of abortion, it's Jesus that makes the difference too. And that is a life-giving solution like the one preborn uses, and that's just taking moms who are in difficult pregnancies and showing their babies to them through ultrasound. It's an amazing miracle because it's just real. And isn't it funny that light just chases out the darkness? As we're talking about these dark things today, and they are dark, and they're terrible, but the light of Jesus, and remember that when heaven comes, we're not going to need a sun because we're going to have God, the radiance, the light of the world, and that pushes out darkness. And so don't be afraid. Don't be oppressed, whether it's this issue of abortion or what's happening in the world. Don't be oppressed because our God is the God of light, the Father of light, In him is no darkness at all, and his light is going to push out the darkness of abortion and also of these heinous killings and attacks. So if you'd like to help in the issue of abortion, it's only $28 to show the moms their babies inside and help them make a good decision, and most of them do. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Go there and make your most generous donation. Well, this is Sandy Rios 24/7. You can listen to us on any podcast platform. You can email us. And by the way, we're going to be doing an email show pretty soon here at sandy@afr.net. Love hearing what you have to say. And I share as many of your email as I can on the air. You can also call us at 662-821-2040. That's 662-821-2040. You can find us on social media platforms, and you can also go to sandyrios.com, listen to the show, and find out more about what we're doing. All right, well, today we're going to go to Daniel Greenfield, who is the CEO of the Horowitz Center out in California, actually San Francisco. His moniker on Twitter is Sultan Quiche. Pretty interesting. Daniel's been writing. He hasn't been my guest in a long time for no good reason, I have to say. But he is one of the nation's leading experts on what's going on in the Middle East, and he will talk to us about how Iran has been at war with us for 46 years on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
The embassy was seized on the morning of November the 4th, 1979. The operation was prepared by Islamic leaders in the universities in Tehran, who incited 400 students to go storm the American embassy. Despite the revolutionary turbulence and anti-American sentiment in the country, the embassy did not increase security. The Marines, who were ordered not to shoot, didn't resist for very long. The American diplomats who'd been controlling Iran for decades underestimated the siege carried out by a group of 20-year-olds. At the beginning of the hostage crisis, Iran had only recently come under the rule of an important religious dignitary, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who quickly donned the cloak of supreme leader of the nation. His followers called him Imam Khomeini.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. Today, my goal really is to help you understand that we have been at war with Iran for 46 years, according to our next guest. And I know that's true because I lived through it. But I think the vast majority of Americans don't have a clue, because our government has been feckless in the way they've responded to Iran and in many ways covered up the fact that Iran is really the heart of the danger in the Middle East, more than Iraq, more than any of the other countries. And we're going to make that case with someone who knows all about it. His name is Daniel Greenfield. Daniel is the CEO of Horowitz Center. Now, David Horowitz was a very dear friend of mine. David was one of the radicals of the 60s, and he came out of that movement. You heard him on this my program many, many times through the years, because he became actually a very strong conservative and has written some of the most powerful books countering the left culture of anyone, but also tracking what's happening in the Middle East, the truth, the hard truths. Front Page Magazine has been publishing, and Daniel Greenfield has been writing about this stuff for many years. And so, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure, as always. Thank you.
All right, so how long do you think, just for yourself personally, how long have you been writing about the Middle East conflicts, Daniel?
Ever since 9-1-1, unfortunately. I was in downtown New York City on that day, and I decided I needed to speak out, and everything that has happened has come from that.
Yeah. All right. So, we need to say, I did not say this. David Horowitz recently passed away, I think about 3 months ago, wasn't it, Daniel, something like that?
A bit less, but yes, he passed away. He'd been battling a health crisis that we've been battling the left for 2 decades, and he held on for as long as he possibly could have.
Yeah, and so, but he made such a mark, and now you are taking on the Horowitz Center, and in his after his passing, and you're going to be leading that, and I'm very grateful. And by the way, Daniel tweets under the name Sultan Kish, which always makes me laugh, but it's really not funny anymore because we're getting really close to the bad sultans in Iran. But if you want to find his stuff, Sultan Kish is his Twitter handle. And all right, so let's start with this, Daniel. What is different? Americans know about the Iraq War. A lot of people are opposing that are conservatives. Any involvement with Iran, because they've had it with long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's different about Iran from, say, Iraq and Afghanistan? What's different?
First of all, there's just a lot of false claims being put out there. The only thing even being discussed here is having the United States maybe bomb an underground nuclear reactor. Nobody's discussing actually having, you know, the United States come in and do regime change, but boots on the ground. The people pushing this claim, for the most part, are just people who are, for whatever reason, trying to save the Iranian regime. And we've been at war with Iran for 46 years. There are people who said, no, we can't go into another war. Well, Iran has been at war with us for nearly 50 years. And they've killed around 1,000 American soldiers during the various wars that we've already had in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were the ones who supplied IEDs. They put a bounty of $1,000 on the head of every American soldier that the Taliban and other jihadis would kill. They were responsible for multiple bombing attacks on U.S. embassies and facilities, including the Marine barracks bombing in Beirut that killed 220 Marines. It was the largest toll since, I believe, the Vietnam War. And they're still at war with us. They've killed about 4 American soldiers in the last 2 years using their Shiite allies in Iraq to carry out drone attacks. So they've been at war with us. They're still at war with us. We can pretend that they're not at war with us. We can pretend that if the regime remains intact and gets nuclear weapons, that even though they chant death to America, they'll never actually do it. But no, that's living a fantasy, just like we were living a fantasy before 9-1-1.
Yeah. So, Daniel, that's a good overview, and I want to talk about some of that in more detail. Because people don't know what you know and what I know. Some of the stuff you wrote about in your article, by the way, I want to feature today, is called Iran Has Been at War with Us for 46 Years. And that's Daniel's latest article on Front Page Mag. It's frontpagemag.com. Iran has been at war with us for 46 years. And I think this article is going to be something that will be a great tool for many of you to understand why Iran is different. And I think, also, Daniel, don't you think, yes, they've been at war with us, aggressive war with us for 46 years. But in addition to that, they had this eschatology, I guess we would call it. They believe that they are destined to rule the world through this, what, fourth imam? I don't know, want to get into the weeds with that too much, but can you? Doesn't that also make them slightly different from, say, Iraq or Afghanistan?
Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam, and yes, they believe, you know, both believe that they have a destiny to rule the world, that they have to destroy us. The Shiite version is a bit different. It's got more Persian mythology baked into it. And yes, they believe that there's going to be an epic showdown, and yes, of course, you know, Islam has to rule the world. Otherwise, nothing else makes sense, and that requires destroying Christianity, requires destroying Judaism. You know, they say their version of Jesus is going to come back and break the cross and kill Christians. So it's very messed up. And, you know, people say people believe whatever they believe. But in this case, this is a religious regime. You know, what they believe drives their politics. When they say death to America, this is really coming out of their religious beliefs. It's not just a political statement. This is what they believe has to happen because Allah will make it happen.
Yes. And it's a theocracy, not a democracy. So whatever the religious leaders believe, that's how the government acts. We have a separation where there are many Christians here and Jews, but our eschatology about the end times doesn't cause laws to be passed in our Congress. Maybe it should, but it doesn't. And so that's a big difference. So they live and die by this stuff, literally. And so let me go back a little further, because I don't know the answer to some of these things, and I don't want to put you on the spot in case you don't know the answer, but the Shah of Iran, I was listening to a lot of clips preparing for this conversation with you, and in one of them it talked about how the Shah, they claimed the Shah was a really terrible dictator and that the people, he was oppressing the people. My memory's different, but do you know, Daniel, what the circumstances were that caused him to be overthrown? He was the leader in Iran for like 30 years, something like that, before the Ayatollah took over. What do we know about the Shah?
Primarily opposed by Islamists, the ones who eventually took over, and leftists, particularly communists. They made an alliance together to seize power, and of course the jihadists then purged the communists, as usually happens in the Middle East. Now, was the Shah an ideal American-style democratic leader? You know, I'm not Persian. I have not lived there. People's opinions on the subject can be subjective. You will find Persians in America who are great admirers of the Shah, say how much better things were. There are others who were very unhappy with him. You know, I'm going to kind of split the difference and assume that it was not, it was not America. But, you know, life was good for a whole lot of people. Certainly life was better for pretty much everybody than it is today. And while, you know, people are now talking about having the Shah, having, you know, the Shah's son come back into power, I don't think we should get overcommitted to that. Nobody's really seriously talking about regime change. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said that it's not a goal. If Iran's regime falls, good, but that's up to the Iranian people. And I think that's true. You know, if the regime becomes weakened enough and discredited enough, it will fall and people will figure out there what they can replace it with. We're not doing nation building here. That said, you know, if the current figure, Reza Pahlavi, comes in and he becomes a kind of a crown monarch, a constitutional monarch, you know, maybe that could work, but it's really up to them. And I think we really need to emphasize we're not doing nation building here. And because a lot of people are doing these scare tactics, they're saying it's going to be Iraq, we're going to be doing nation building. We're not.
Yes, and besides that, the other way that Iran is different too, Daniel, that's significant to me, is it, as far as I know, besides Israel, it's the only country in the Middle East, to my knowledge, that has ever been really westernized, had lived with a certain amount of freedom, women able to dress freely without having to wear burqas, and getting educations. There was a lot of freedom in Iran, and that's never, I don't think any of the other countries can say that. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, and so the people remember that. They remember the freedoms. The women remember that when they were not beaten, you know, for looking at some other man or for not obeying their husbands and worse. So there's a memory of freedom.
Absolutely. You know, with Arab Muslim countries in the Middle East, they're pretty much hopeless. Lebanon is the exception because it has a sizable Christian population still. With Iran, we're talking about a country that's an ancient civilization. It was part of Persia and the Persian Empire. And there's a lot of culture there, and there's certainly a lot of hope for a better society in places like Tehran that are currently under the boot of the theocracy. I would also say Turkey, there's some possibility that, you know, if the Islamist regime would fall there, it would become a good country again. So it's different. You know, I would compare it to Japan and Germany after World War II. We didn't really need to do that much to reconstruct it because there was an underlying memory of democracy, of a better world. Whereas going into Afghanistan or Iraq, well, there was never really anything there to reconstruct. So there was never really any hope there that it would become a better society.
Was the Iran hostage situation the first big act of war, really, against the Americans by the Iranians back in 1979? Was that the first?
Well, yes. There was no previous hostility between Iran and America before Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers began taking power. And interesting thing about the Iran hostage crisis, and I say that I think most of your listeners probably remember, but not everybody does, as far as the so-called student protests, much as we're seeing on campuses today. And the students came in, they surrounded the embassy, and they claimed that we were peaceful, we just wanted to do a sit-in. And the embassy guards were not authorized by the Carter administration to defend the embassy. And, of course, once they came in and they realized the Americans were not going to shoot them, they took over. And there's a lesson for us in that. When we allow ourselves to fall for these tricks, when we don't actually defend ourselves, we don't actually show that we're willing to stand up, we're setting ourselves up for another Iranian attack.
Yes, in fact, I want to develop that even more, because Jimmy Carter was president then. And we played this one clip already where it said that the embassy, in spite of the revolution, did not beef up security. And I've seen videos of this. I mean, there's not even a gate around it. And so the Marines, and we heard this in a clip earlier, but I want to underscore it, were told not to fire their guns. Don't fight. So these, 200-300 students just marched in and took all of the people in the embassy hostage and kept them in captivity for 444 days. People don't remember this, Daniel. That's why we have to restate this. And the point in saying that is that under Carter's administration, they did not beef up the embassy, and they told the Marines to stand down. What kind of madness? You know, that reminds me of Benghazi and life under Obama and Hillary Clinton. That's that same kind of madness, Daniel.
It is indeed. And when we talk about students on campuses or the students in the Iranian hostage crisis, these were jihadists, these were Islamist organizations, and we're seeing the same thing now being set up on college campuses, and we're not paying sufficient attention to it because the Democrats, the left, the ideological descendants of Carter, they go around and they say, well, these are just students, they're young people protesting. When, this is how it actually ends, with these jihadist groups being incubated on college campuses to wage war in America. And it's not just happening in Iran now, it's happening at Harvard.
Absolutely. And to continue this kind of narrative about Carter there, I'm going to play another clip, because this illustrates this other incredible weakness he showed. And this is clip 3. Let's listen.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, who had always been opposed to any military action, resigned. A tough blow to Jimmy Carter, who lost an important member of his staff and a friend. Once the failed operation was no longer a secret, the American president asked all his advisers to let their Iranian contacts know that the United States had no intention of invading their country. His top concern was saving the lives of the hostages.
All right, so my point in playing that, I'm sure you know what it is, Daniel. He's got, we've had a failed attempt, which he oversaw, to rescue the hostages who, again, were held for 444 days because they refused to secure the embassy. And so then they have this failed attempt, and he tells all the people in his cabinet to contact their Iranian contacts and tell them, oh, no, we won't invade. Don't worry, we won't invade. Who does that? Seriously, Daniel, who does that?
You never want to take options off the table. This is why President Trump promotes this kind of calculated ambiguity, this you don't know exactly what I'm going to do, whereas the Democrats would insist on signaling, we're not here to hurt you. No, we just want to talk to you. And if you do that, you take out all the pressure, then, of course, at this point, you're just a joke. You're suckers waiting to be punched in the face. And that's what they did. The Iranians, I should note, and their Hezbollah proxies and others continue taking hostages in Lebanon, most prominently, and elsewhere. They're still holding at least one American hostage after all these years.
Well, yes, it opened the floodgates because we, as you and I both know, but people don't know, that's why I'm saying these things, Daniel, the Arab world, the Muslim world, hates weakness. In fact, Khomeini actually ended up, because he began to hate Carter and hold him in complete disdain, because Carter's trying to be Mr. Nice Guy, and they hate him for it, and that's why they actually released the hostages on purpose 15 minutes after Ronald Reagan took the oath of office as president to humiliate Carter. They did that because they hated his weakness. So as you're making the point, they just continue to see us because I don't know what you want to say about that failed mission to rescue the hostages. I know a lot about it, but what are your thoughts about, was that a good faith attempt? Can you say that Jimmy Carter, that was a foolish endeavor? Or what can you say about that?
Well, on the military end, there were obviously mistakes made, but the political end, the Carter administration was not truly committed to a rescue operation. And what would have actually made more sense is to have done a large operation, one that took out major targets rather than this kind of shoestring operation to just go in, get out. That was always high risk. And I know the first time they really ran into difficulties, they avoided and they just dropped the whole thing because they really did not want to do it. It reminds me of the efforts under the Clinton administration to take out Osama bin Laden. They had multiple chances to do it, but they found ways to mess it up because they really were not committed to doing it. So when you really don't want to do something and you're tentative about it, well, you just kind of explore it. You put some options on the table. You try something, and then the first time you run into trouble, you abort it because you're not seriously with it.
That's exactly how I see it too, Daniel. We've got a good friend who was part of that rescue. Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin is a good friend. I don't know if you know who he is, but he was one of the yes. So that's another story for another day. I can go into that more maybe later in the show with my listeners. But one thing you point out in your article, which is Iran has been at war with us for 46 years, is that the Ayatollah Khomeini boasted, by holding our hostages, America can't do a damn thing against us. And that's been a refrain of the religious leadership of Iran since then. No matter what they do, that's what they think. So
yeah, it's literally a slogan that they had hanging on buildings. They still have it hanging on posters today. America can't do a damn thing. And it's very important within the Islamic framework because how they show the supremacy of all of their religion is by carrying out attacks and then showing that the infidels, the Christians, the Jews, the Hindus, the others, they can't do anything. They can't fight back, which means that Allah is supreme. When they shout Allahu Akbar, they're saying Allah is supreme, and they prove it by attacking us and then showing that we can't do anything against them.
All right, I want to take kind of a timeline here. You in your opening statement to us, you gave us a lot of information, but forgive me, Daniel, I want to slow you down a little bit because I want to make sure people remember. The problems did not end just because the hostages were released. In fact, I think the next time they raised the Iranians tried to humiliate America was in 1983 in Beirut. Can you please explain what happened there?
So there was the Lebanese Civil War, the one that ended up destroying really Christian, you know, Lebanon was at the time the only Christian majority country in the region that was still left. The others had their Christian populations defeated, oppressed, subjugated in various ways. Lebanon had a Christian majority, was really the Christian equivalent of Israel in some ways. And unfortunately, the Civil War, the fighting first by Arafat, the PLO, and the so-called Palestinian terrorists, and then by the Shiite jihadists, who were Hezbollah, and they'd been backed by Iran. So domino theory in the Middle East with the Shiites was that first they got Iran, then they got Lebanon, which they now pretty thoroughly control. Hezbollah took quite a beating, but they're still in control of it. Then they're now taking over Yemen. They took over Iraq. So this was a war that really the United States should not have intervened in the way that they did. The Reagan administration made a number of mistakes when it came to Islam in particular, unfortunately, and trying to bring in peacekeeping forces into Lebanon, into Beirut, was a catastrophic mistake. But for Iran, it was an opportunity to go after Americans, to take control of Lebanon, and to visibly carry out attacks. And they bombed the U.S. embassy. They carried out a second attack, which was the attack on the Marine barracks in Beirut. It killed 220 Marines, 21 other service members, and they continued. They continued attacking and killing Americans, taking Americans hostage, in some cases executing them. Their targets were the American University in Beirut. They also kidnapped, tortured, and killed a number of people, including the CIA station chief, William Francis Buckley. They would send out videotapes of him being tortured to the United States. They also kidnapped and tortured and killed Colonel William Francis, William R. Higgins, who was, again, brutally tortured and killed. So they were, again, showing that they could torture and kill Americans, they can continue doing this, and we would not be able to do anything at all.
And we didn't do anything. You know, I was thinking in that Lebanon conflict that you just described, that's where Brigitte Gabriel comes in, because that's Brigitte's, she was a Christian, young Lebanese Christian who was hiding with her parents for years through this war. So It's interesting, Daniel, isn't it? That I don't know if you have a personal connection, but it's interesting to me that people who have gone on to really fight and understand the Middle East, they're friends of ours, and this is their story. Between General Boykin and Brigitte, it's just two personal stories. But 220 U.S. Marines killed, and again, we do nothing. We really do nothing. And so then it goes into more modern times, Daniel, and this is what people may remember now. After that long conflict we had in the Middle East war for us, Iran was targeting our soldiers. Can you please explain what they were doing, how they were involved, even if they weren't fighting on the battlefield?
So, take a step back. Iran had actually made an arrangement with Al-Qaeda early on before 9/11. They trained some Al-Qaeda terrorists. Some of the 9/11 terrorists actually came through Iran. Now, as the United States actually went into Afghanistan, they made a connection with the Taliban. As I discussed earlier, they began providing IEDs. And in Iraq, which had a Shiite majority, they also began providing IEDs and other weapons, which were very effective at killing Americans. They put bounties on the heads of American soldiers, and they built up a terrorist infrastructure, which still exists today. You've heard of Hezbollah in Lebanon. In Iraq, there's something called Kataib Hezbollah, which is effectively the same thing. Hezbollah means party of Allah. And Kataib Hezbollah is continuing, by the way, to attack and kill Americans today. And by today, I mean there were three Americans killed in 2024 by Kataib Hezbollah. And again, we've done nothing. We've carried out some light airstrikes, and then we go back to business as usual.
You know, I did. I actually do want to. I know this is very detailed, and I apologize, but people need to understand. It can't be a broad sweep. In 1985, Hezbollah, their proxy, hijacked TWA Flight 847. Navy diver Robert Sethem was beaten and kicked to death before his body was dumped onto the tarmac. I'm reading from Daniel's article. They were jumping in the air and landing full force on his body. He must have had all his ribs broken, Yuli Derrickson, the stewardess, described. I was sitting only 15 feet away. I couldn't listen to it. I put my fingers in my ears. I will never forget. I could still hear. They put the mic up to his face so his screams could be heard by the outside world. That's in 1985. And I did forget also this huge event that you mentioned briefly, 9/11. Now, I've heard before from good friends of mine that Iran was really, in many ways, responsible for 9/11. Can you make that very clear? And if you believe it's true?
Well, certainly they were part of it. They actually provided the training to Al-Qaeda operatives. Al-Qaeda operatives under Qasem Soleimani, you may remember him as the Iranian terror boss that President Trump took out in his first term. Under Soleimani, they actually went to and from Iran, which means Iran was moving them around. And to believe that Iran had no idea what they were up to is unrealistic, because they were capable of pulling off a sophisticated operation that really no Sunni terrorist group up to that point had been able to pull off. And I have trouble believing that they would have been able to manage that all on their own. Now, the 9/11 Commission report specifically does state all of this, that they were passing through Iran. And by the way, do you know where the current head of Al-Qaeda is? Saif al-Adel, the current head of Al-Qaeda, has been in Tehran for the last 20 years or so. Some people say he's moved to Afghanistan, but as far as we know, he's still in Tehran. So Al-Qaeda's leadership has spent a whole lot of time in Tehran. During President Trump's first term, the U.S. and Israel worked together to take out Al-Qaeda's second-in-command once again in Tehran.
You know, I was just thinking the same thing about people. President Trump is in office, and I feel this way, Daniel. You don't have to feel the same way I do, but I think President Trump understands most things. And I don't think he's naive about Islamists. I don't think he's naive about Iran. And it makes me wonder, you know, why he chose Soleimani. I mean, it's like he is a New Yorker. He was there when the 9/11 attacks took place. New York was the city that is still the city that he loves so much. And so he oversaw the taking out of this Soleimani, which is, at the time, it seemed random to me because I didn't have enough history in my head to understand it. But it's not random. So here we are, and as a matter of fact, last night, Daniel, I know it's early in California, but the Iran struck our U.S. embassy in Israel. Is that right? Let's see. Yes, in Israel, with Mike Huckabee. They closed it down. So that happened last night. And so it's the same old thing, only not the same thing. So now we're at the precipice of something. Their nuclear weapons have been damaged by Israel, but obviously there's a lot more to do. And so how do you read the current situation yourself about what Israel's accomplished and what has to be done to stop this yet?
So what Israel's accomplished is breathtaking as far as winning the aerial war goes. They achieved air superiority in less than a day over Iran. It's incredibly impressive from a military standpoint. They've been trying to take out as much of Iran's nuclear program as they can. The problem is some of that is buried underground, particularly at Fordo, where they have underground enrichment going on. And Israel has only so many bombs capable of actually reaching that. We're better at it. If we were to go in with some serious bombers and actually destroy some of that underground infrastructure, it would make the world a whole lot safer. But for now, what Israel has achieved is impressive. The Iranians are continuing to fire missiles. They're, you know, doing damage, but it's kind of like, you know, the Nazis in the last months of World War II. They were shelling London. They were shelling. They were firing V2 rockets on England as much as they could. And they were certainly doing damage and killing people, but they were losing the war. And, you know, effectively, what Iran is trying to do is cause as much damage as possible, inflict terror, but the Israelis are not intimidated, and it's important for us to also not be intimidated. So the moment we actually back off and start talking about making a deal with Iran, it's not a coincidence that Iran then goes ahead and actually tests, it pushes, because this is what Islamic terrorists in general always do. They test, they push, they do something, and they see how we react. If we don't actually show strength, and they see us as being weak, and it's just like the Carter administration over again. They're going to start hitting harder and testing and pushing and trying to manipulate us and offering to negotiate and then pulling back, because all this really is about what in the Middle East is called being the strong horse or the weak horse. If we show we're strong, then they actually back off. They actually are willing to do something maybe. But if we actually show weakness, then they're going to come after us.
Yeah, I find myself wondering if President Trump isn't calling that, giving them 2 weeks for a reason that we probably don't even need to think about. But I think maybe there's a reason. Last night, I just got this morning, Daniel. I've been told that Prime Minister Netanyahu and IDF Chief of Staff Zamir, Defense Minister Katz, Minister Dermer, and other Israeli senior officials held a discussion last night with U.S. Vice President Vance, Defense Minister Hegseth, and other senior U.S. government officials. There's a lot happening, And President Trump has already said he is willing. You know, he feels like if we have to do this, we have to do it. And I think he's serious about that, Daniel. I think they've tangled with the wrong guy. You end your article with a really good synopsis about how the various administrations have, the way they handled what's happening in Iraq has led us to this. You just want to say a word about that, starting with Carter. Even you say Reagan was weak in his handling. Just be interesting to have a little overview. Carter, we've discussed, but how about Reagan and Bush and Clinton? And then, of course, Obama, we should say something about him. The contrast in how they handled this.
Because Reagan was focused, laser focused on communism and the Soviet Union, and anything that distracted from that global conflict, he didn't really have time for, and he didn't really foresee that after communism, that after the Soviet Union fell, this would actually be the big conflict, and that was a failing, but it was an understandable mistake. Even if some of the things he did, like making deals with Iran, were a huge catastrophic mistake. Clinton did not have that excuse. It goes without saying. The Clinton administration was eagerly appeasing every Islamic terrorist group out there. The moment the Taliban took over, they tried to rush emissaries to them. With Iran, it was much of the same thing. And by the time you get to Obama, of course, it's utterly catastrophic because Obama is actively empowering America's enemies. He's actively helping Islamic terrorists take over part of the Middle East. And with Iran, he's very eager to end U.S. sanctions on them. He's rushing to make a deal with them that he eventually does make. And he's telling his negotiators, you have to understand the Iranians. They're very, very upset and angry about the United States. They're feeling very insecure. We have to make them feel better.
You know, I saw some of that in those videos I was watching about how, you know, Iran is so upset with America and we need to back off and be kinder. It's it really is the coward's way, and it is not working. It's not working. And as I say, you know, Daniel, they're not going to stop attacking us just because we don't feel like fighting. They're not going to quit until they have used one of those nuclear weapons on the great Satan, the United States of America. They're just not going to. But there are some risks, and I want to ask you about this because I really don't know what to think about this. I've heard mention of assassin teams here in the United States. Are there Iranian assassin teams as far as you know?
Well, we have actually two people being indicted for plotting to assassinate President Trump before the elections last year. Clearly, they've tried to do it. They try to do it using Americans the way the Chinese do. They like using. But we know that there's extensive infrastructure that they have in the United States. Hezbollah, which is the Lebanese terrorist group controlled by Iran, has spent a lot of time building up drug and other trafficking operations in the United States. We know actually that the Obama administration told the DA to leave them alone because it would upset Iran. So they're entangled with the cartels. So where the cartels are, the Iranians also are. And the cartels are obviously very present in the United States. So they obviously have the ability to carry out attacks here. You know, we've seen even Salman Rushdie, the English author who had been targeted for a long time by Iran, who was actually attacked and stabbed repeatedly in the face not that long ago. They certainly have the ability to carry out assassinations in the United States, and the Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has come out and said, you know, what does death to America mean? It means death to Trump. So, you know, he was pretty explicit about it. Some people in the media say it's a metaphor. There are different ways to understand it. It's not a metaphor. It means death to Trump.
I don't know why we wouldn't believe that. I mean, we took out Soleimani and other Iranians, and they hate us. And, of course, President Trump is the one driving this opposition to them. That is just common sense, and I don't know why people would even wonder about that. But, Daniel, one last question. We have, you know, we have so many, well, during the Obama years, the Iranians rose up and tried so hard to revolt against the Khomeini regime. And they were out in the streets for weeks and days, and President Obama just completely turned his back on them. And then when they were murdered, captured, tortured, what do we know about the strength of that movement now?
So this seems to be protests in Iran. There's still there's definitely a political opposition in Tehran and some other cities of people who just want reform, women who want to be free. And I'm here in LA right now and near Beverly Hills, and Beverly Hills is heavily Persian. It's got a Persian mayor, actually, I believe. And it's very conservative. And you have banners here, Woman, Life, Freedom, commemorating the protests that are in some cases still ongoing. So there's definitely an opposition of people who would like the regime to fall, and these are very westernized people. And there's other opposition movements also across the country, including probably whatever opposition movement the Israelis are working with, because they have trouble believing they could have done everything they did, including building a drone factory without having some sort of friendly forces on the ground. We just know very little about it. The problem with the political opposition, the protesters, they're very heroic. They're very courageous. They're willing to go to prison and have be tortured. And the women who have lost their, you know, eyes in this, they've been brutally tortured. But at the same time, it's not the same thing as having a successful military opposition that can fight back. And I compare it to the fall of the Soviet Union and what happened in China and Tiananmen Square. When Russian democracy protesters went out into the streets, you know, the Russian military was sent out, and they were there in tanks, and they refused to fire on the people. They refused to take action against them. In Tiananmen Square, when the Chinese went into the streets, the People's Liberation Army and tanks had no problem going after them. So in Iran, it's very much a China model for now. They have these IRGC, which is their terror core. That's what Soleimani was running. That's what the Israelis have targeted. They've got Bashi militias and others that are really propping up the regime, and they're willing to use violence against protesters. And as long as that continues, I don't know that peaceful protests are going to do it.
No, and I think given the fact that they just bombed our embassy in Israel, that's kind of Khomeini's, it seems to me, to be an answer from Khomeini to President Trump's, you know, saying he's going to give them two more weeks. I think that's like a thumb in his eye. So I think we know what's going to happen here. Something big is going to be happening. Daniel, it's such a pleasure to catch up with you. And honestly, I want to commend this article again to all of you listening. Iran has been at war with us for 46 years. The details are in the article, and it would be just a great way for you to inform our friends, because if we get into this thing, we're going to have a lot of naysayers, as we do leading up to it. And we're not talking about all-out war, but we're talking about helping Israel to finish the task and get rid of the nuclear weaponry as best we can, so that they are no longer a threat to the United States and to the free world. Daniel Greenfield, CEO of the Horowitz Center, a.k.a. Sultan Kish. Again, his Twitter handle is Sultan at Sultan Kish. Is that right? Sultan, K-N-I-S-H.
That's right, yes.
Okay, all right. Sorry, Daniel. All right, Daniel, God bless you, and thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you for a great conversation and for all that you do.
Okay, thank you. Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
And the FDA finally approved the French abortion pill. And again, there was two pills. They okayed the first one, mifepristone, for chemical abortions up to 7 weeks. Later, that was extended to 10 weeks under Barack Obama. And then under Joe Biden, they opened the door to the FDA approving of mifepristone prescriptions online, through the mail, and without any kind of supervision. And the Supreme Court upheld that unanimous ruling just in 2024. It really is despicable. I'm telling you, it is despicable, given the number of injuries, 10% or so of women who have these chemical abortions, not to mention the loss of life, the trauma of delivering at home. It is a disgraceful thing that our country has done. But Preborn is trying to provide a redemptive way to stop it. They have a pill that can actually reverse that first pill. And the first one is mifepristone. So if a mother has second thoughts when she takes that first pill, if she gets to a preborn clinic, they can stop that. But if she takes the second pill, which expels the baby, it's too late. And that's why we're trying to educate women, not educate. I hate that. Just really too sterile. We're trying to move their hearts by showing them their baby in utero through ultrasound. That's what preborn does. That's the emotional trigger, which is genuine and real from the heart of God. That's a baby. And when women see that, they don't take these abortion pills. It stops it before it begins. But both things have to be addressed, and that's what preborn does. If you would like to help, it's $28 for one ultrasound. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And please make your most generous donation.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Khomeini's followers thought that the hand of God caused the operation to fail. Iran, which piously followed the principles of Islam, was protected. The Ayatollah Khalkholi, who carried out the regime's dirty work, had the charred bodies of the American soldiers put on display for the press. After this propaganda stunt, the bodies were handed over to the Swiss embassy, which represented American interests in Iran.
The Swiss embassy took possession of the bodies, which obviously had great significance for the Iranians. So it was a bit difficult to convince them that they nevertheless had to be taken away so they could be brought back to the United States.
All right. Well, the one thing I wanted to you to hear on that was that what we said earlier, that Khomeini and the Iranians, they believe that they're being favored by God. It was the hand of God that that rescue mission, which, by the way, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin was part of, you know, he's told his story on the air here with me before. It's so gripping. It was a life-changing event for him. And I'll just pause to say something about that. He had his men on a helicopter that burst into flames. And before they went out to do their mission, this is landing in the deserts of Iran to try to rescue these hostages, these 53 hostages at the time. He was the special forces guy. And he prayed with them before they left. He prayed with them. There's actually a photo of him praying with them. And then they took off, and then they got caught. Their helicopter caught on fire, and all of his men got caught in this horrible inferno. And he fell to his knees, and he begged God to save his men. Just begged God. You know, basically, as I recall, I don't want to put words in General Boykin's mouth, but he said, "Lord, we just prayed. We trust you. Please, please, please save these men." And what happened? One by one, they crawled out of the flames. One by one by one, 100% of General Boykin's men survived. And it looked like they were coming, according to him. I remember him saying it looked like they were coming out of the gates of hell, the flames of hell. They all survived. That's the good story of that horrible rescue that went so wrong. It was a complete failure, and many lives were lost, but not in that case. And the reason I mention that, because that we're talking about the hand of God. Khomeini believes the hand of God is saving them to rule the world. He believes that the failures of the United States are proof that Allah is great and that they have his favor. General Boykin and I have a different God, and God delivered his men on that day. And then when we go back, interestingly, in Scripture, you may remember there's a King Cyrus. He was the king of Persia. Persia was a great empire then, and there were many Jews who lived there. They'd been carried off into Babylon and other parts and dispersed, and they longed to go back and establish Jerusalem. They longed to go back to their homeland. And Cyrus, God spoke to him, and Cyrus let them go back. He gave them supplies. He gave them everything they needed. They went back, rebuilt Jerusalem, and reestablished the nation of Israel. That was a Persian/Iranian king named Cyrus who God used to save the Jewish people and to reestablish Israel. And then we have the story of Esther, the queen. Esther was a Jewish bride to a Persian king. And she, remember, she took this strong stand of faith to save her people. So that's our link, biblical link. There is there's a history of Iranians and Israelis, or Jews, whatever you want to, what terms you want to use, having this wonderful relationship. It's not impossible. And God willing, the right steps will be taken. I guess I just want to ask all of you to pray for our president. They would love to kill him. They'd love to kill all of us, but he is the tip of the spear. And he's the one bearing the weight of the world on his shoulders right now. All right, well, before we say goodbye, you know, I couldn't do this without the help of Timothy Plant. They're one of our big sponsors, and they help you learn how to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.